but very much interested, how does memory actually work? Not so much about, yeah, we have to remember something, but are we as historians the keepers of memory? How does that work? And what material will help us with that? So besides teaching about Zionism, German Jewish and Swiss Jewish history, and the conflict in the Middle East, you can never get a dull moment, you can always ask and answer a lot of questions. I did a long research about memory, remembering, and I will start with one of the sayings that historians used to say 20 years ago about the contemporary witness. And we used to say, the witness to history is the historian's biggest enemy. So don't disturb my wonderful research with all your ideas about history, what you experienced. This is nothing I don't want to hear. And I asked myself, why do we trust documents so much? Why aren't we critical with documents? If you write your memory down, that's reliable. Okay. Although we all know how a book was produced, everybody, a lot of people read it, correct it. But if you tell me your story, I think it's not reliable. So I think we have to think about that a lot. And in the last, I would say, 15, 20 years, there is a change in historiography so that we really work with contemporary witnesses, which I think is very good. And if we turn to Judaism, we find a wonderful example how it works. Remember, we have a Torah, a written Torah. Oh, we trust reliable. But we have an oral Torah as well. And then someone came up and said, we could talk about why, but we leave that aside, that we have to write down the oral Torah as well to keep it alive. So in the end, the Mishnah and the Gemara were written down, and the editor of the Mishnah, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, in the around the second century Common Era, he wrote it down, and we trust him. Maybe Rabbi Yehuda had a bad day when he wrote about Rabbi Gamliel, and so we maybe have to look at it. Maybe he thinks, I don't like him, so I write something else. So, but we trust it. It's written down. So the Talmud is a wonderful example how actually all history, oral tradition turns into something written, but it's still developed. Because we can say there is a Talmud, but we can talk and there are new ideas. And if you go into the Talmud and read it, this is something I really like. One says that, the other says that, and there is a decision, and the next decision, wonderful. That's how history should be done.
Everyone is valid.
Memory. And if you talk about memory, there's always the beginning, it's a memory of a society. There is something that is called a collective memory. And I was always very suspicious with the word of a collective memory because I don't like to be part of a collective. You can't be free anymore. There's a collective memory. There's creating a group identity out of individual memories, and then there's this group. There's a wonderful book in German saying there is no such thing like collective identity. Except for some tribes in Africa and the Jews. So you think, okay, now that's something, you know. What does that mean? There's no collective identity, no collective memory, except for the Jews. What does it mean? And then we turn to scientists like Abi Warburg, Maurice Halbwachs, or especially in German language, Jan and Aleida Assmann, and we get all these ideas about memories of a society. And they say there is something like a communicative memory. That means around 40 years, we hear from contemporary witnesses about events. But then something will happen. There will be no contemporary witnesses anymore, and then there's something comes up that's called cultural memory after 40 years. And after Jan Assmann wrote that, his wife Aleida Assmann split it up. She said, yes, it is cultural memory, but this is divided into functional memory and storage memory. Functional memory is what we use every day. Storage memory means there is something somewhere and we can, when we need it, we can bring it up. But usually we don't need it. Whenever I was involved in discussions about that, I thought, I don't like that. I don't like all these categories. I think that the word memory here is a wrong, is a category mistake. There must be something else. And I went to down to the individuum. I said, I want to know how a person works, how a memory of a person works. Not so much about a society. We can talk about society later. But first of all, I want to know, how does this memory thing work? And there are a lot of theories about memory, and I was very happy that during writing my habilitation, the internet provided me with a lot of American science news journals so that you can really get to the newest developments, a lot of theories. And what I like most is, first, the discussion, what does this memory actually mean? How does it work? Is it a computer? Can I ask for my memory? Ah, I have to remember that. You remember the test in French where you missed this word? So you couldn't switch on the computer and say, give me the French word for whatever. It doesn't work. It's kind of a storage. Can I open a drawer and find something? So today we think, no, it doesn't work like this, it's something else, but at least a little bit we know. First of all, we say there is what is called implicit memory in a person. Implicit memory means kind of a body memory. I know how to turn on the watch like this. This, I can do it, you can wake me up at 12 o'clock in the night, it works. That's what's called implicit memory. I don't have to think about how do I put my watch on, I know this. The body knows it. More important for us is what's called explicit memory. The implicit memory sits in the cortex, the explicit memory in the hippocampus. More important, and this is divided as well, in the semantic and the episodic memory. Semantic memory are the facts. A fact is like in math, when you know 2 plus 2 is 4. That's semantic memory. Episodic memory is everything about you. The point that this is divided, we know that from persons who got brain damage during an accident. And there's a very famous person called Patient K in the United States who lost all his memory about himself, but he didn't lose any fact memory. He has no idea who he is, but he can tell you everything about mathematics, the capitals of all of the world and all of that. So there is a division in the brain. So we say episodic memory, that's about ourselves, about our life. And the good thing is, this memory thing, this brain, will keep in mind what the brain thinks is important, what had an impact. Positive or negative. A long time we thought it's mainly the negative things, mainly the positive things. We can't divide that. This is positive, negative. What has an impact will keep in your brain, will keep in your mind. But these memories will not stay in your brain like somewhere. They build networks. Whenever you experience something, the brain tries to look, did you experience something else before? Can we connect that? So the brain tries to put an event into a scheme, to put it into a relationship with something else. We say today that the experience of the Holocaust is something that has no scheme in the human brain. A trauma like this has nothing where the brain says, I compared with that. So maybe there is a kind of what we could call a Holocaust network, something like that. But there's something else. And we heard that yesterday afternoon when Michael Brenner talked about his father. When he said that his father didn't talk about what he experienced. And we have this. A lot of you said, ah, my father didn't talk as well, my mother didn't talk as well. And it's kind of a thing where you say, yeah, the trauma must be so important, so big, that the people aren't able to talk. Neuroscience says something else. The memory has the ability to block. There's an inhibition, like a border, because the brain protects you. It makes sense. The brain doesn't want you to have all this memory all the time, so it blocks it. This is why today, when you have a big accident somewhere, you always hear, the psychological help is already on its way. And Israeli scientists say that's the wrong way. You should not talk at the very first minute about what you experience. You should let it go. 2, 3, 4 weeks maybe, not talk at once. To rebuild it, to relive it anymore, every day. So the memory has the ability to block it. And what will happen after 30, 40, 50 years? Imagine you were a young kid, and all of us 15, 16 years old, something. You live your life, your professional life, and around 60, 70, you finish work, kids are out of the house, and then the brain is not able anymore to control the memory. And this is very, very fascinating for us as historians, because that means that with the age of 70, 60, 80, whatever, the memory comes up. And it's not that you can say, that's an old person. I mean, if he remembers that correctly, what happened 60 years ago, no, that's exactly the wrong way. What a person remembers from the age of 20 when it's 70 or 80 is much more reliable than when I ask my friend, well, how was it last week in this wonderful restaurant in Basel? And he said, yeah, last week was great, or maybe it was 2 weeks ago, I can't remember. So for us as a historian and for oral history, that's important to know that an older person's memory is much more reliable than if I try to remember what happened last week Sunday. I took a trip to the Chiemsee. I hope. But there's no such thing like authentic or name it correct memory. This is impossible. Imagine you would be entitled now to remember everything from this lecture. This means every word, every move I make, every person in the room, the temperature, everything. You could do this. It would drive you crazy. You just forget enormous amount, just what's important for you. Yes, we know from neuroscience and working with neuroscience that the more often you tell a story, it's not that you remember the actual event, but that you actually remember what you told last time. This is something critical and we have to deal with that. And yes, things we hear and things we see can change memory a little bit. A lot of work done on that. What happens if you show people a movie about the time, a trauma they experience? Will they involve this movie into their talks? So we have to be critical with that as well and have a good look at it. And the brain creates two more things that we have to be very careful with. One is called false memory. A false memory means I will tell you that we met 2 years ago in Hohenems. I remember it vividly. 2 years ago, and I never even talked. And she said, I haven't been there 2 years ago. I was last year. They said, no, not last year. 2 years ago, I'm so sure. She said, no, I wasn't there. So I have what is called a false memory. It's not a lie, but it's a false memory. The other thing is called an honest lie. An honest lie is something, although it sounds a little bit not too bad, an honest lie is something you experience and see a lot during the trials after 45. When people, SS people, get asked, I have an example of one of the nurses of the caretakers in Auschwitz, who was accused of killing people in the winter 42 by himself. There was no order, he just killed people. And a lot of witnesses said, yes, he did it. And he said, I wasn't there, I was in the holidays, it was during Christmas. And he was totally convinced that he wasn't there. All the witnesses said, it was him, we can say it, we know it. He said, no. That's what's called an honest lie. So doing all this work about the individuum, I was very convinced that we have to look at every person and talk with every person about their memory, work with it, because we can't put people into a collective whatever. So sometimes I stick with my favorite philosopher, Ernst Bloch, Principle of Hope, who said the human being will never be short of its own personality. You will always be your own person. But what will happen if there will be no more contemporary witnesses? Around 6 months ago in the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, Harald Welzer, one of the very famous researchers in Germany, gave an interview about this, and he said, yes, there will be, at some point there will be no more direct contact, but maybe this will free historiography. It will free historiography a little bit. It will be easier without contemporary witnesses, of which we have to take care of because of dignity. I think this is very, very wrong. This is a horrible quotation. What does it mean? It will be easier. We can't talk about it anymore. So I think it's important to talk to witnesses right now. But what we experience as well here, and we had it during our celebrations here, is always the question, do we really talk about memory or do we commemorate? Do we remember or do we commemorate? And commemoration is very important, very, very important. We need rituals to do it, but to commemorate is not to remember. Memory and to remember is a living process, what we experience here during our discussions. We thought about it in Basel, if we should do something for the refugees that were not allowed in coming to Basel, and we decided against kind of a statue or something. Instead, we tried to create as guided tour through the city to tell people about places. So to do something else, not something where we can commemorate, that's the place where we think, the refugees, bad time, and now let's go on. But to put it more into a society. Yes, history and memory are a first place arsenal for politics and to work history in their own direction. We have it now with the IFD all the time. Imagine 30 years ago something, quotations like that, it was impossible. We have to work against that because what they do is that they work on what they call the German identity without any respect for history and memory and responsibility. So now you would ask me, and how do we do this? How do we pass on memory? How do we keep on memory? I think it's a combination of a local place with memory, like here in St. Ottilien. There are a lot of places, but we are here in St. Ottilien, so we talk about that. And it can be done by talking or by any other cultural performance. It doesn't matter, drawing, music, whatever. But talking is important, and I want to say there is a language to talk about it. We must have a language to talk about it. Nicholas Waxman published, I think 2 years ago, his big book about the concentration camps, calling it KL, the because KL was the Nazi signature for concentration lager, Konzentrationslager. And he said in the beginning that he has no language to describe what actually happened. Then he wrote 1,000 pages. We must have language. Do it with your students. Ask them about the color blue. Describe blue. Describe it with your words. Imagine you have to describe it to a blind person. What is blue? Then you see we have to have a language, and if we don't have a language for that, we don't have a language for anything, and we have to talk to get it. What else we have to do, I think, is with all this memory thing and putting it into a performance, into a museum, into workshops, and try to disturb the expectations of the visitors. Breaking the way people look at things, or what people expect from an exhibition about the Holocaust, try to get them involved. You know, my favorite thing for Berlin, for this Denkmal für die Ermordeten operation, was not this thing. My favorite thing was getting rid of the Brandenburger Tor. There was a suggestion like this. You remember? He didn't make it to the second round, I'm very sorry. This was I thought this is like, break this view.
Yes.
Do something else. I experienced it when I take my students to a concentration camp near 90 kilometers from Basel, Natzweiler Strothof. Although it's only 90 kilometers from Basel, most of the students of history haven't seen it. So usually we went there every 2 years, take them there. And the last time we went there, it was in December, it started snowing in the middle of the trip. And it snowed like hell in France. And actually the street was blocked. They only let our bus pass. So we came to Natzweiler Strothof, we were the only group that day. I had to sign that I'm responsible for everything that will happen if someone breaks his leg or something, so I signed it. And then we went there with 20 people alone in Natzweiler Strothof. Natzweiler Strothof was one of these working camps with an incredible death rate, and they did all these medicine things with people. A horrible place. So it was only 20 students and the camp full of snow. The impression was unbelievable on the students. Another thing that is important is to work with students when we realize where they come from. There was an exhibition in Switzerland called The Last Swiss Holocaust Survivors. The title is a little bit mistaken because it was not Swiss Holocaust Survivors, but it was Holocaust Survivors who came to Switzerland after the Holocaust. Big pictures, like the ones here in the background, like that, just the faces, black and white. And one of my former PhD students had a group with mainly boys, 16 years old, coming from all places in Europe. They looked at the pictures and they didn't know what to do with it. They had no idea what to do with the Holocaust. They had no idea about this. For them, these people were rich Swiss older people. So my former student said, listen, look at them, look at the stories which is written down there. They were all immigrants, like you. They were all immigrants like you. They came with nothing, just their life, survived, and then they came to Switzerland. And that was the point where they got the students talking. I conclude with Sahor. First of all, Sahor is a very famous book by Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi, who published it in 1982, and then we started talking about all this remembering thing. And I remember in 2000 something when we had a conference in Elmau near Munich, when one of his students, David Meyer, said to him that, Mr. Yerushalmi, you are the best here. You made us think about it. And Yerushalmi was very angry. He said, I'm not, you misunderstand everything. This was very interesting. That first scholar I see who didn't want to have these, want to be praised. But it's an interesting book, a very important book published till today about Jewish history and Jewish memory. What was important about Sahor is something else. It's the word itself. Yerushalmi said it appears 165 times in the Torah. There are other people who say it appears 180 times. Doesn't matter. For me, the important point about Zachor is in Exodus Shemot 17:14. And the Lord said to Moses, write this for a memorial in a book and rehearse it in the ears of Yeshua, for I will utterly put out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. Write this for a memorial in a book, for I will utterly put out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. So not only talk, but write. Write it down. Not only talking is important, but even writing a book. That's what some of you did. We'll have this evening a talk with Bob Hilliard, who did it, who wrote a book. That's another important thing, how to remember and how to pass it on to the next generation. Thank you very much.
Working, yes. Two or three comments, probably at the end. First of all, it's very easy. The Mishnah was sealed in 200, and the Talmud or Gemara in 500. So it's absolute numbers. The other thing that your lecture reminds me, I've just finished to read Victor Klemperer's memoir or diary that he wrote in Dresden all along the years. So he did, first of all, it was a daily written down fact that he has the access to know. And the second thing is the process of the human being to absorb the disappearance of all his friends and peers and working mates and everything, and to be able to be afraid of himself and the future. I mean, this is not an historical something that was concluded by historians. This is personal experience. So in this respect, this memoir is in accordance to what you have just said. And the third thing, personally, if I may have 5 or 10 minutes to add another angle to the discussion that goes on. I was not aware of the whole thing before I was invited to come. But I would say that my father dealt with the education and the unification, the assembly of the youngsters here and all over the American region, zone, and even in Bergen-Belsen in the British zone. And they erected and established what they called Noham, the youth movement to build kibbutzim in Israel, inclined by Zionistic inclination. So if you find a few minutes for me to get into the discussion, I might gladly be doing it. Please.
So thank you very much. I mean, Victor Klemperer is a wonderful example. He had the advantage that he was able to write in a wonderful way.
But, you know, if he would tell me that his story, if he write it down, it's always a process, and writing down a process is something else. If I would ask you now, tell me the story, you would do it very differently. If I would say, here's a pencil, write it down, this is something else. And we, as historians, we have to take that into account, right? About this different storytelling, but important is that he told the story. And I'm very happy that the Klemperer Diaries got such a popularity and people really read it and work with it. That's absolutely important. And the other thing is an anthropological thing. One of the psychoanalysts who worked in Israel and Switzerland, who worked with people with Holocaust survivors and who used to tell them that they have to get over it. Go on with your living. And he told me, it's of course it's difficult if you tell a person, you know, forget your trauma and live. But he said it's the only way he can work with people. Not keep on, tell me about it. And you know, psychoanalysis usually says, tell me about it. But he says, we have to do it differently. Very interesting. And we are still in a process, by the way. I don't say that this is now full stop and that's it, but we are still working on it. Thank you.
Hello. For the benefit of those of us like me who have not taken the Brandenburg tour, can you talk a little about what faults you found in it and why you're glad it's gone as a way to illustrate your point?
I thought when they started talking about we have to do something to remember, it's always to put something in, to build something. But what you do? I mean, to put it a little bit hard, you killed 6 million people and then you build a museum. And you do it very seriously, you know. Remember when the former German Chancellor Schröder said it has to be a place where you like to go. Like to go? Yeah. Enjoying it? Hey, let's go there. So I thought there must be something else. And Rolf Hoheisel, that's the artist who suggested it, did a lot of projects like this. He did a fountain in my hometown Kassel. The fountain was in front of the mayor house, like this, like a pyramid. It was destroyed in 1938, and then he built it again in the 1980s, but not like this, but in the ground. You stand on glass, you look down and you see it. And I really liked his work, and this thing with the Brandenburger Tor, and then the unification and all of that, and we have a Germany, and hey, and wonderful. And I'm a child of the Bonner Republic, I'm sorry, you know. So I thought we have to do something that really says something. And destroying the Brandenburger Tor was for me something like this. Yes, I know everybody from Berlin will be shocked, and no, you can't do it, it's such a symbol. That's it. It is such a symbol. You know, there were other suggestions like on the highways around Berlin, you're only allowed to drive 80 kilometers an hour. And they put little bumps in the highway so that will remind you. This, you know, highways in Germany. You know. But this Brandenburger Tor thing really intrigued me, really got me. But of course, it was done. They did it like this now. And I mean, I'm very happy that they did a museum there as well. And not only this Schneelen. So that's why I thought the Brandenburger Tor idea was a good idea, but you know, I'm very alone in the world with that idea, by the way.
But there is Gedenksmalkirche.
Yeah, Gedenkskirche. Yeah. They rebuilt.
They did?
Yeah. It's a little. They rebuilt the palace now.
Yeah,
this former.
Okay, thank you for a very thought-provoking talk. So my question specifically is looking at, let's call it generations of memory. It's very striking that here we are gathered and we have among us many children of survivors who are here. And one of the things that I find fascinating is how memory gets transferred from one generation to the next. And it's very clear even in this room that it happens in many different ways in many different families. And among siblings, it happens differently. Some take on the mantle of carrying the flame of memory, others do not. Some parents talk, others do not. So my question for you is thinking about how this process happens, how it's transferred from one generation to next, and what the children of survivors, what role they're going to play in the future. Because you alluded to this idea that historians feel some sense of relief, perhaps, because there is that tension. The carrier of the memory, the survivor perhaps has a memory, and we're working in the archives and sort of parsing it out. But I think the children of survivors are also sort of going to play a very important role in pushing this forward in the next generation. So I think this will continue. And I think one of the things that I like about what's happening at this symposium is that we're all engaging in this memory work together. So I just want to hear what you think about sort of that.
No, I totally agree with you. Totally agree. This is something we used to talk about, second generation, not as a part of a memory, but something else. And now, in the last years, we realized second generation has something to say as well. It's not about telling us what happened, you know, like this old Ranke thing, we want to know what happened, but let's talk about your experience. Tell us about it, tell us what you heard, what did you do with it? And this will be a lot of different stories. As you said, some parents talked in the end. Look at Michael Brenner, he's now so close with his mother. She talked a lot to him and maybe influenced him a little bit in that way. So I think second generation, and then of course third generation. But we have to think about what can we do, what can we get out of it? You know, when we do this project about the last Holocaust survivors and the last contemporary witnesses in Basel some years ago, somebody asked us, yeah, you only have Jewish witnesses, where are the perpetrators? We said, look, these were children. The perpetrators, we can't interview them anymore, but we can try to get a second generation there as well. Talk about it, which is a difficult thing to do. We know that, but second generation and, as I said, third generation, there is passing on of memory, and not only talking, but with a lot of things. I don't know if you're familiar with Savinyon Liebrecht. She's an Israeli writer.
Yes. Sure.
And she wrote a story about a girl in Israel who came home and her grandmother cut off all her hair because she brought a little piece of paper saying, in the Gan Yeladim there are lice. And so the grandmother was back in Auschwitz, and she cut the hair off, and it was a catastrophe for the family, this grandchild. And this is second generation, third generation. The second generation shouted at the grandmother, said, well, how can you do it? You're not anymore in the Holocaust, you're in Israel. But she was back in Auschwitz, and the third generation had to suffer from it. But we have to deal and think about it very thoughtfully.
Thank you very much. I know there are many more questions, but we're really like short of time. Maybe we can postpone it after the panel.
Ask me afterwards.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So our next talk is going to be in German, so I'm going to switch in German again. Ich darf Ihnen jetzt ganz herzlich Jutta Fleckenstein vorstellen, die den nächsten Vortrag halten wird. Jutta Fleckenstein studiert in Erlangen und in Rom deutsche Geschichte und 2002 arbeitete sie